Hello, this is John Harcher, and welcome to Keep On Groovin', my look at the legacy of Jimi Hendrix through the albums that have come out over the 50-plus years since his unfortunate passing. Jimmy's my favorite music artist, and for someone with such a short career time frame, just 4 years, he really packed a lot into it. Very few artists could hope to have as successful a career, let alone the one he's had after he died. Since that sad day in September 1970, there have been three distinct eras of posthumous Hendrix releases, each with their own merits and drawbacks. What I'll try to do is take a look at everything that's been released up until now and see what was done right, what could have been done better, and what probably should have stayed in the vaults. I'll also be mixing in my thoughts on some of the books and videos that have come out during that time as well. You'll hear me mention the Steve Hoffman mention boards a number of times along the way. It's run by the eponymous mastering engineer, who's made a killer sounding Who's Next, among many others. And it's my go-to place for music, talk, and news. If you're into any aspect of music, historical, technical, old releases, new releases, you name it, you can find info there on just about anything. It helps soak my interest into doing something like this, so a tip of the hat to the guys over there. You'll hear me mention some names from time to time, and who knows, maybe along the way, something more. We'll see how it goes. One of the holy grails of unreleased rock albums like Smile and Lifehouse is First Rays of the New Rising Sun, the two albums that Jimmy was working on when he passed away. There is an album in existence with that name, but it's not the album it was supposed to be. Will we ever get that album? No. As Jimmy intended, no. As something closer to what he intended? Well, possibly. But why wasn't it done right after he died? That story really starts when Jimmy was still alive and on the verge of having a number one album. Episode 1, The Mike Jeffrey Era, 1971. Jimi Hendrix, Noel Redding, and Mitch Mitchell wrapped up recording of Electric Ladyland in late August 1968, with the album coming out in October. Before the album was even released, they began working on a fourth LP. After a three-night stand that month at Winterland in San Francisco, they traveled down to L.A. to TTG Studios, and for about 2 weeks, they recorded material for the next album. Unfortunately, not many songs were completed. Then in February 1969, while getting ready for their gigs at Royal Albert Hall in London, they tried to do some more recording at Olympic Studios, the place where they had great success recording parts of Are You Experienced and all of Axis Bold's Love, as well as All on the Watchtower and Crosstown Traffic from Electric Ladyland. But again, apart from a couple of good jams and some ideas for songs, not much got done. Once back in New York in early April, at two different studios, they tried one last time to make some headway. This time they got a few more songs done, but nothing approaching the amount needed for even a short album. Within 2 months, the experience would be broken up for good. Manager Mike Jeffrey thought about putting together a live album from material recorded at Royal Albert Hall, the LA Forum in San Diego, or possibly releasing his set at the Monterey Pop Festival. In the end, he opted for a revised version of the UK singles collection Smash Hits to fill the gap. Filled it pretty well. It was Jimmy's best-selling album for decades. Over the summer, Jimmy decided to put together an expanded band, complete with Mitch Mitchell from The Experience on drums, two extra percussionists in Juma Sultan and Jerry Velez, and a second guitar player, old friend Larry Lee. Another old friend from his days on the Chitlin' circuit, Billy Cox, had been playing with him on bass for the past few months. This is the band that played Woodstock, without a lot of practice. It wasn't particularly tight, but when Jimmy went into the Star Spangled Banner, well, that's kind of what everyone remembers. Jimmy took that band into the Hit Factory's studio in New York to see if they could get something recorded, but again, they got some jams and song ideas down on tape, but nothing official. In the meantime, Jimmy had another album he needed to work on, as well as the one he owed his own label, Reprise Records. An old contract he'd signed back in the mid-60s had resurfaced, and a court ruled he owed producer Ed Chalpin and Capitol Records an album. An idea came up that he record a live album at Fillmore East and make that the old album. He, Billy Cox, and drummer Buddy Miles had jammed on and off for the past 6 months, so they would be the ones who would take the stage on New Year's Eve as the band of Gypsies. They had done some recording in November with producer Alan Douglas, much more on him later, then some more on their own through late January. They began to make progress on long gestating songs like Easy Rider, Isabella, Message of Love, and Room Full of Mirrors, as well as a number of new songs such as Earth Blues, Burning Desire, and Power of Soul. But a disastrous aborted performance at Madison Square Garden put an end to the band of Gypsies. Jimmy and producer Eddie Kramer finished work on the record for Capitol, and Band of Gypsies came out in March, shooting into the top 10. During this time, Jimmy was in the process of building his own recording studio on West 8th Street in New York City. The project had gone way over budget, and manager Mike Jeffrey was hoping to get some cash rolling in by sending Jimmy back out on the road. In spring of 1970, Jimmy, Billy, and Mitch headed out to begin a long series of weekend concerts, which would leave the band time to stay in the studio during the week to continue work on the album. They began recording at the record plant in the spring, but finally in mid-June, Electric Lady Studios would open for business. Once there, it was like a dam broke. For a year and a half, it was almost impossible for Jimmy to finish one song. Now he would finish a backing track, do layers of overdubs, then sit with Eddie Kramer and mix the tracks, sometimes several times over. He got so much done, he was contemplating putting out either a single album called Straight Ahead, a double album called First Rays of the New Rising Sun, or even a three-record set called People, Hell, and Angels. He might have even had enough material to put aside for a soundtrack Jeffrey had committed him to for a film called Wave, a film that had its name changed later to Rainbow Bridge. There was also a film project revolving around his concert at Berkeley in late May of 1970. He even had a single, Dolly Dagger, ready to go once he returned from a European tour in fall of 1970. Unfortunately, he never got back. Once Jimmy's funeral passed, there were two projects on the immediate horizon: Jimmy's next album for Reprise and the Rainbow Bridge soundtrack. Both would come out in 1971, both different than originally intended. The Cry of Love. Soon after Jimmy's death, his manager Mike Jeffrey gave Eddie Kramer and Mitch Mitchell the job of putting together a single album of the best songs Jimmy was working on. So the dream of the double album First Rays of the New Rising Sun would disappear for a generation. Some songs were pretty much done, a couple needed a little bit of work, but all of them had been in Jimmy's notes as being intended for the next album. They put together a 10-track LP with the following songs: Freedom, Drifting, Easy Rider, Nightbird Flying, Room Full of Mirrors, Dolly Dagger, Astro Man, Angel, In From the Storm, and Belly Button Window. All set, ready to go, with the name of the album, The Cry of Love, named after the spring and summer tour Jimmy undertook to help pay for the studio. Jeffrey stepped in and pulled off Room Full of Mirrors and Dolly Dagger so they could go on Rainbow Bridge. Now they needed two more songs to fill out the album. They found one in Straight Ahead and the other in a song from 1968 called My Friend. So let's take a look at each one of these songs individually. Along with Dolly Dagger, Freedom has its roots in a song Jimmy recorded just after the Experience finished studio work in 1969 called Crash Landing. We'll be talking more about this title later. But the song was done with a bunch of guys Jimmy was hanging out with at the time to see if he could find other people to work with. It was about his tempestuous relationship with Devon Wilson, and some of the lyrics ended up in the two previously mentioned songs. The music developed out of a jam with the Band of Gypsies during the final recording session in January 1970. One that would yield a lot of future material. Jimmy, Billy, and Mitch did a loose demo in March and continued to work on the song through the end of August. It was one of the new songs that was regularly featured on tour in both the U.S. and Europe, with versions from Berkeley, Atlanta, and Isle of Wight released later. Some of Jimmy's last mixing work was done on this song. He cut out what I call a little breakdown jam towards the end of the song and still needed to do one overdub right before that edited section. But all in all, the song was practically complete. On the other hand, Drifting was a work in progress. It appears on the legendary Black Gold demo tape as part of that song cycle. So it may have appeared on the next album, but might have slipped if he ever intended to do Black Gold as its own album. He mixed a version in August, but it wasn't finished. Eddie Kramer ended up taking a backing track from June and a lead guitar from July and putting it together in one take. Then to finish it off, he brought in Buzzy Linehart, who'd done some recording at Electric Lady before Jimmy did, to put some vibes on the song. With the glockenspiel on Little Wing and the recently released vibes-infused demo of Angel, it actually fits right into Jimmy's catalog. Now the next song, Easy Rider, has a somewhat diffused origin. The earliest version of this song, or part anyway, was a track from December 1967 called Touch You, which ended up as a B-side to a single release from the 2010 box set. This same track shows up on an acetate single with Noel Redding's Dream on the other side as a song called Dance, sung by Mitch Mitchell. So is the song actually Noel's? He seemed to think so, and everyone pretty much confirms that both songs on the acetate were Noel's. So that's the intro riff. Later in June 1968, Jimmy and Mitch recorded a song called Inside Out that ended up as like the middle eight bridge section of the song. They did a full complete version at Olympic Studios in February 1969, and in April he recorded a song called Lullaby for the Summer, which is kind of a later evolution of the Touch You dance riff type thing. By the time you get to the Band of Gypsies recording section, all these little bits and pieces have come together into one song. Then added to the mix a hit film that came out earlier that year called Easy Rider, change up the spelling a little bit, E-Z-Y-R-Y-D-E-R, and you get this song. It's the only song on Cry of Love that features Buddy Miles on drums. He was also on Room Full of Mirrors, but that's on Rainbow Bridge now. When Jimmy got to Electric Lady, this was practically the first song he started working on, replacing some parts, overdubbing others. Steve Winwood and Chris Wood from Traffic stopped by to see the new place, and having both been veterans of the previous album, Electric Ladyland, Jimmy had them do backing vocals for the end of the song. You can't miss hearing Steve Winwood's voice at the end of the song. Easy Rider was one of four songs that Jimmy felt confident enough to play for an audience at the opening party for Electric Lady on August 26, 1970. It was played at a couple of the Band of Gypsies shows, and like Freedom, was a pretty regular part of the 1970 tour list. Nightbird Flying was another one of the songs that made the Electric Lady party tape, since it was going to be the B-side of the Dolly Dagger single. It started life as a song from 1969 called Ships Passing in the Night. It developed into a quicker and somewhat countrified version, and that's what this became. There was a story around that Jimmy had named the song after the famed New York DJ Allison Steele, known as the Nightbird. However, considering the source of the story was Allison Steele, I take it with a grain of salt. To the best of my knowledge, Jimmy never did a version of this live at any point. It did get an unexpected tip of the hat, however, by, of all people, the band Squeeze. Towards the end of their song, 8535937, I know, I have to read this. It's not as catchy as 8675309, but, you know, they're British. What do you expect? And towards the end of that song, up pops the opening rip to Nightbird Flying. My buddy Ray, a diehard Squeeze fan, didn't believe a Hendrix song would pop up in a Squeeze song until I played them both back-to-back for him. Glenn Tilbrook has recently put a killer acoustic version of Voodoo Child out there on the net. Check it out. It's really cool. Now, My Friend is one of the two replacement songs on the album. In some ways, it's really out of place since it was recorded in March of 1968, before most of Electric Ladyland was even started, let alone done. It doesn't feature the Experience, but a group of disparate musicians. Stephen Stills is on it, but only plays a little bit of piano at the beginning. The harmonica is credited to someone named Gers, but in reality, it's really the space alien expert from EXP himself, Paul Caruso. They made it sound like they recorded it at a bar with like clinking glasses and all. It's a very low-key song, kind of introspective and autobiographical at times. The friend he talks about is the only person who's always there when he looks in the mirror, namely himself. In a way, it's actually a good replacement for Room Full of Mirrors. When putting together posthumous Jimmy compilations, I usually don't include this song with the other ones from this album since it's practically from another era in Jimmy terms. But Eddie Kramer said Jimmy took out the tape to listen to while working at Electric Lady, so that's why it was probably on his mind when he was looking for another song. It's certainly worthy of release, that's for sure. Straight Ahead is the other replacement song, and to be honest, I think this should have been on the album the entire time. Jimmy was working on the song quite a bit through 1970 as it began in his live shows as Pass It On. The lyrics were so meaningful, they actually put them on Cry of Love's back cover, so for me, it's hard to picture the album without it. It's a pretty, no pun intended, straightforward song with not a lot of overdubs. For that reason, some Hendrix fans think he really wasn't done with the song, even though it made the Electric Lady Party playlist. He'd remixed the song about four times in the last week he was at the studio. Considering it may have been the title track of an album, had Jimmy decided to go with a single record instead of a double, it really is a key song of this latter era. Now, Astro Man is a bit of a goof, but it comes from Jimmy's fascination with superheroes and science fiction. There's a few critics who aren't exactly comfortable with it because it uses the other F word, the one with six letters and not four, but, you know, lighten up, folks. It's a song about someone who's twice as fast as Donald Duck. Let's not get too worked over. It began as a jam with the Band of Gypsies, some of them lasting well over 10 minutes. Later on, it got refined down into a normal 3.5-minute song. Now, to me, I look at it the way some of the other guys think of Straight Ahead. It doesn't sound like completely finished. It's a little on the sparse side. Plus, it was another song that was done on the Black Gold tape. So maybe he was going to try to hold it back until later. Now, were there other songs they could have used instead of Astro Man? Yeah, but, you know, it's okay to have a funny tune once in a while. When you start scraping the bottom of the barrel and come up with funny songs, well, we'll get to that later on. Next up is Angel. It's another song with a long gestation period, this one going back as far as Axis Bold as Love. The Experience recorded an instrumental demo for a song called Little Wing that sounded just like this one, but decided to use that name for a different song. He then recorded another demo with kind of a primitive drum machine click track type of thing. Later in January 1968, he recorded another version, this time with vibes. It wasn't until March and a solo home demo tape that he finally came up with words for it. Then it wasn't until Electric Lady Open that he finally put the full song to tape. When they were listening to the song after Jimmy died, Eddie decided to have Mitch go in and not replace, but double his original drum part. It gives the song an otherworldly feel compared to just the single drum part, which can be heard on some bootlegs and Voodoo Soup. We'll get to Voodoo Soup later on. It's thought that the angel is his late mother, who, truth be told, was far from one, having abandoned Jimmy, his dad, and brother Leon, reportedly for a life of hard parting that ended sadly in 1958. But I guess he had this idealized version of her in his head, and this song, and maybe Little Wing as well, represented that. Rod Stewart covered this song on Never a Dull Moment, but I'm kind of surprised it's not more popular. Maybe it's just too personal a song for other people to cover, whereas Little Wing can kind of be more of a generically emotional song. I guess that's good of an answer as I can come up with right now. Compared to Angel, In From the Storm was barely a month old when Jimmy recorded it. He did bits and pieces of it in a version of Cherokee Mist in June earlier that year. By the end of July, he focused it down and called it Tune X, just came in. To me, this signifies how energized he was working in his own studio, that he was able to come up with a song, get the band to rehearse it and record it, bring in backup singer Amberetta Marks, and have it almost ready to go by the time he left for the Isle of Wight Festival. He liked it enough to perform it at Isle of Wight, as well as earlier at the Rainbow Bridge concert at the end of July. So it was going to be a big song for him going forward. Jimmy did a mix on August 22nd that included some out-of-sync drums. Kind of sounds weird, but I guess it was the effect he was looking for. Eddie went back in and did a cleaner mix for this album. Now, Eddie and Mitch chose to close the album with another relatively new song, Belly Button Window. There was a four-track recorder in the studio for Jimmy to go in and record ideas he had. After he died, almost all those tapes disappeared except for this one. Jimmy made this demo with a wah-wah overdub and later had the band record a full instrumental version as well. The sparse, quiet version suits the song perfectly for a baby who's wondering what kind of world is he getting into. Some people took the lyric, "You only got 200 days," as some kind of forecast. Jimmy's forecasting his own death. Like, no, it was written for Mitch Mitchell's baby, who was still inside his wife at the time. It's an uncharacteristically quiet ending for a Hendrix album, but under the circumstances, an absolutely perfect choice. Cry of Love hit the top 10 when it was released in March 1971, so it showed people were still interested in Jimmy's music. Rainbow Bridge. Mike Jeffrey was a deal maker, constantly looking for the next thing to bring in more cash. Some of his ideas around this time in 1970 became a bit more eccentric. None more so than signing up Jimmy to provide the soundtrack to a film by Andy Warhol protege Chuck Wein. He's the guy who introduced Edie Sedgwick to Andy. Part of the film would be a concert performed by Jimmy, Billy, and Mitch in Hawaii during the sensory experiment, whatever that is, which took place on the side of a volcano. When they got there to perform, no one took into account that the side of a volcano on an island may not be the optimal place to hold a concert to be filmed for later distribution. The winds were so heavy, the road crew cut out large pieces of yellow packing foam to wrap around the mics, which gave them a distinctive one-of-a-kind look. You see a picture, you know where that was recorded from. It isn't really known if Jimmy was seriously thinking about what songs he could possibly use for the film, if any. Originally, he refused to have anything to do with it and didn't write anything for its use. Jeffrey had to talk him into doing the concert, and look at how that turned out. Maybe towards the end, he relented and resigned himself to it, much like what happened with Band of Gypsies, you know, just kind of make the best of it. What became clear was that a fully live soundtrack album was out of the question. In fact, none of the material at the concert would make the album. Eddie Mitch and assistant engineer John Jansen began to look for other things to use. One of these was a mixtape of sorts made by Jansen but rejected by Kramer, since it took three completely different songs and put them together. This tape, however, would see the light of day, but in a slightly different form. Now, there's not an official listing to the songs the three chose for the album. My guess is, like Cry of Love, it was originally a 10-song album. What is known is, once again, Mike Jeffrey stepped in at the last minute and pulled off two and maybe three songs off the record to hold for later. So once again, Eddie and Mitch had to go find more material, and once again, they chose pretty well. Now for the songs. Dolly Dagger was to be the big crowning jewel of First Rays of the New Rising Sun. Jimmy had taken lyrical themes from Crash Landing, added some sly twists regarding Devon and voracious personality, and pretty much put it together in about 6 weeks. It was going to be the first single. It was on the Electric Lady Party tape. He and Eddie even brought it themselves to Reprise to cut the single. It was all set to be on Cry of Love, but as I mentioned, Jeffrey pulled it off to save for this album. He said he needed to have some strong material to hold back. I understand it from that end. They even worked it into the movie following Pat Hartley around after she landed at the airport. But in my opinion, it was too strong of a choice to take off Cry of Love. Because of that decision and what ended up happening a few years later, it's never really gotten its fair due since it wasn't in front of the public right off the bat. Jimmy did it a few times live, most notably at Maui and at Isle of Wight, but still kind of needed some work to make it sound better live, you know, like Freedom was at this point. But if you want to know where Jimmy's head was at and what direction First Rays was going, this is the first place you look. Now, the movie opens with the song Earth Blues over the opening credits, and you know, it's a pretty good choice. It's another song where the lyrics and music have two different starting points. Lyrically, it had its roots in a song called Somewhere that was recorded around the same time as My Friend. When the song came out in a somewhat different form, it was retitled Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I don't know why they didn't just call it Somewhere Over the Rainbow Bridge at that point, but we'll get into that song later since it's Jimmy's only number one single in the United States, with some caveats, of course. The music started out of a jam with Billy and Buddy and even Devon and vocals from May 1969, called Message from Nine to the Universe. Other parts of it evolved into Message of Love, which ended up on the Band of Gypsies album. And I think I'm going to have to talk about that album next time because it's really tied into how Jimmy's music was evolving post-experience. The Band of Gypsies ended up recording versions of Earth Blues in December and January, and they played it several times at the New Year's concerts. For the studio version, Jimmy brought the Ronettes in to do backing vocals for the chorus. Now, I thought for years Ronnie actually wasn't there, but somebody found a story from her where she talks about going to Electric Lady Studios, so it turns out she was around. That part of the song, where they sing like a gospel choir chanting everybody, it just got on Mike Jeffrey's nerves. I mean, he wanted to hear more Purple Hazes and Voodoo Childs, and he gets this gospel choir chanting, everybody, everybody. Must have driven the guy nuts. Later that June at Electric Lady, Jimmy did some more guitar overdubs and had Mitch replace Buddy's drum part. It wasn't really part of the 1970 tour. I think they did it a bit at Berkeley during rehearsals. Then towards the end of August, he went back and mixed the original Band of Gypsies version. But Eddie, Mitch, and John decided to go with this version for Rainbow Bridge. Kramer mentioned several times over the years he wasn't sure if Earth Blues was going to make the record, which has me wondering if Jimmy possibly had it in mind to set aside for use on the soundtrack. Next up was Paley Gap. Now, Jimmy never recorded a song called Paley Gap. This comes from the productive sessions on July 1st, 1970 that yielded Dolly Dagger. If you listen to that song, towards the end, Billy breaks into a little Gimme Some Lovin' on the bass. This led to a little jam after the fade-out. Then after a few minutes, Jimmy slowed it down and started playing a melody he'd included as part of the same Cherokee Miss jam that gave us In From the Storm. I had to put one of the guys over to see how often message boards were pointing this out. I think it was Pacific Ocean Blue. Take a look and see if you can find it. Jimmy was intrigued enough to go dub another guitar part over top of it. Now, Eddie said they never intended to use this piece of music for the album, but why would Jimmy take the time to overdub something he wasn't going to use? Again, he might have had it in the back of his mind to actually use it for the soundtrack. We just don't know. There's also another, albeit distant, possibility, which also came from the guys from the Hoffman boards and also, I think, Pacific Ocean Blue. Jimmy made a list of songs he was working on to possibly use for the next album, which he called Straight Ahead on his memo. S-T-R-A-T-E. Not great spelling, but if you're writing quick, that's fine. One of the songs he had on the list was called Electric Lady-Slow. Now, the official name of this piece of tape is Slow Part. Is it possible that Slow Part is Electric Lady Slow? Well, if it is, Jimmy apparently never mentioned it to Eddie. So how did it end up on the album under the name Paley Gap? Well, very simple. After the decision was made to use it, Mike Jeffrey made up the name Paley Gap because it sounded very Hawaiian. Hey, you know, whatever works. Next up is Room Full of Mirrors, the other track that Jeffrey pulled off of Cry of Love. And to be honest, it really fits in better on this album. It's way more psychedelic than any of the tracks on the other album. It started out as a demo way back during the Electric Lady sessions with Paul Caruso on harmonica. The inner sleeve of that album had a note from Jimmy called Letter from the Room Full of Mirrors. It made a notable appearance at Royal Albert Hall, with Dave Mason and Chris Wood from Traffic joining in for a loose jam version towards the end of the February 24th concert. He tried a couple different versions from 1969 along the same lines, but a little tighter, a little quicker. Then in November 1969, he got a version down with the Band of Gypsies that was around 3.5 minutes long. He even did a little slide guitar thing using his ring instead of an actual slide. When they got to Electric Lady Studios, Jimmy tried a number of remixes, but he never seemed to do any major work on it, with one exception. Like Earth Blues, he had Mitch overdub a new drum part over Buddy's. This version, however, didn't get released. They went with Buddy's version. Though, to be honest, I think Mitch's version is the one that's actually in the movie. I can't find my copy right now to confirm it, however. And it's not exactly floating around out there on the internet. They're pretty strict with this one. Now, Eddie mentioned that something wasn't quite right with the mix on the drum part. This is probably what led to what happened on Voodoo Soup, which, as I mentioned, we'll get to later. An alternate take that appeared on the 1988 radio show Live and Unreleased would pretty much break Christopher Walken's heart. It has less cowbell. This was one of the few songs the Band of Gypsies did in the studio, but did not do at any of the concerts. It was also infrequently performed during 1970. I guess it was kind of like Dolly Dagger. Jimmy needed to come up with a good arrangement for how it ended up in the studio. A lot of overdubs, a lot of guitar parts. And it sounds okay live, but we'll get to those later on. Now, Jimmy began performing the Star Spangled Banner in concert in actually late 1968, mostly as the prelude to Purple Haze. It would pop up here and there during the Experience's 1969 tour, but of course it was Woodstock that forever linked them with that song. It was a pretty regular part of the 1970 tour, with a memorable one from Atlanta being performed right on the 4th of July itself. The version on Rainbow Bridge, however, is a studio creation done in March 1969. I don't know if he ever meant to release it, but he really went to town on it. Overdubs at varying speeds and all kind of guitar tricks adding to the chaos. It almost sounds like he ran it through some modern-day effects box to make all these noises, but nope. Just a good old-fashioned Strat Marshall combo with some studio trickery thrown in top. It's pretty unique, and it's a good counterpoint to the live version. As I mentioned, the original track listing for Rainbow Bridge included the song Stepping Stone and Isabella, and possibly Bleeding Heart as well. The first two didn't appear in the film, but the third one did. I'll go into depth on those songs later when we talk about War Heroes. As I mentioned, Mike Jeffrey pulled the songs off the album, so they needed something else to fill up that space. I don't know if Look Over Yonder was part of the original track listing, but this did mark the first time that an unreleased track from the original Experience did get released. It was one of the songs recorded at TTG Studios and one of the few from those sessions that was anywhere near completed. But its roots go further back than that. It was one of the songs Jimmy was performing in his days as Jimmy James and the Blue Flame back in 1966. Later, right around the time Vario Experience was released in early May 1967, the band went back to Olympic Studios to begin recording what would become Axis Boulder's Love. The most important track from those sessions would be If Six Was Nine. But among the other songs they recorded was a kind of funny song called Mr. Bad Luck. They only took one pass at it and it ended up debuting on the 1988 radio show Live and Unreleased. They came back to it at TTG, and this time there was nothing funny about it at all. It had overdubs galore, a frantic urgency, and a crashing ending that sounded like the amplifiers about to come apart. It's too bad they weren't able to put out an album in 1969. This would have made a killer opening track. Next song is Hear My Train of Coming, which was recorded live at Berkeley. Now, what is a song recorded live at Berkeley during here? It's not in the movie. Well, it is and it isn't. Hear My Train of Coming was one of two original Hendrix concert staples that never appeared on an album while he was alive. It was originally called Getting My Heart Back Together and first performed at the BBC in mid-December 1967. A couple days later, Jimmy was being filmed for a promotional short film when the director gave him a 12-string guitar. He restrung it left-handed while sitting on a stool against a white background wearing a big black hat, an image that would become iconic as the cover to the soundtrack from a film about Jimi Hendrix. He proceeded to do a rare acoustic version that was also featured on the soundtrack. From then on, he played it on a regular basis, though oddly not at the two recorded West Coast shows in 1969, LA and San Diego. There were numerous other versions, however, at Winterland, Royal Albert Hall, Woodstock, and the First Band of Gypsy Show. It was also played at the Rainbow Bridge concert, but as I mentioned, the version there was unusable, at least as far as the producers were concerned. However, there was a version that appeared in the film Jimmy Plays Berkeley. I'm going to talk about all the live stuff next. So to have something represent the concert material, they decided to put this song on to represent the live concert. I know it's a strange choice, but lucky for them, it turned out to be Jimmy's ultimate version of the song. There's very few other versions out there that reaches the height of this particular version. Now, the album ended with a song, Hey Baby, subtitled New Rising Sun. It was recorded during the same session that yielded Dolly Dagger and Peely Gap. Hey Baby is the other key song to First Rays of the New Rising Sun. In its earliest incarnation, it was called Hey Gypsy Boy. He recorded a version of that with Buddy in mid-1969. Starting at the beginning of the 1970 tour in L.A., it began to show up regularly on the set list all the way until its last show at Isle of Femarn on September 6, 1970. This studio version is acknowledged to be the most complete and comprehensive, but it's at best a solid backing track in need of a lot more work on the overdub front and fixing the vocals. Eddie Kramer purposely left Jimmy saying, "Is the microphone on?" to show this was a work in progress. On the 2010 box set West Coast Seattle Boy, a version was found where Hey Baby was paired with Jimmy's bolero, also called Pride of Man, into a single 11-minute track. I kind of wish they put out the full version back then. They could use the instrumental in the movie, but it did help establish the song as an entity on its own. Temple of the Dog, or officially MACC, put out their version of Hey Baby on the Jimmy tribute album Stone Free in 1993. Chris Cornell does his usual excellent job on vocals with that song. Now, the film Rainbow Bridge itself was, well, befitting someone of the Andy Warhol school. Jimmy only appears in the back half of the 75-minute film in two segments. A concert segment of around 15 minutes and an interview where he saunters into a back room. One reviewer mentioned looking as bombed out as Dresden, which is a pretty good line, and proceeds to talk about, Cleopatra and choking and stuff hippies understand, I guess. You know, I don't know. Chuck Wein complained that his original vision had been corrupted and people didn't get to see the film as originally intended. In 2000, the full 123-minute version was finally released and it didn't make any more sense than the 75-minute version. There was this neat little addition of Jimmy leaning out of a window and shooting a hippie droning on and on about something, but don't worry, it's just a dream sequence. We did finally get the answer to where that picture of Jimmy holding a gun came up in the inner folds of Cry of Love, though. The film ended up on the B end of drive-in double features, but the album hit the top 20 in both the US and the UK. So 1971 gave us a double album by Jimi Hendrix, albeit separated by 7 months. At that point, they could have taken a step back, let things settle down a bit, and let people get a chance to miss Jimmy. And of course, that isn't what they did. Next time, we'll be discussing the live albums of Jimi Hendrix, both the ones that came out while he was alive and in the first year or two after he died, and see how those releases establishes some practices on releasing the material, as well as what they added to his recorded legacy. I'm John Hartshaw. Thanks for listening. See you next time.